calendar this afternoon. Two patent cases, one from the district court, one from the trademark office. An international trade case, two government employee cases, one of which is submitted on the briefs, will therefore not be argued. First case is Third Wave Technologies versus Strategy, 06-1209. Mr. Lee.
Thank you, Your Honor. In the Queens of Court, my name is William Lee. Together with my partner, Lisa Pirazzolo, I represent the Appellant Strategy. With the Court's permission, I would like to address three issues today. First, the issue of preservation of objections to the Court's claim construction. Second, the correct construction of the providing and mixing steps of the asserted claims. And third, the issue of damages, particularly given that in this case, the jury was expressly informed that an injunction would issue, and that therefore, the period of the hypothetical license was only 18 months. If I turn to the first issue, the issue of preservation, or stated conversely, waiver of objections to the court's claim construction, I think the court could fairly characterize the party's briefing as tis so and tis not. And to sort through that, I'd like to focus the court on three clear portions of the record, one from Strategy, one from PWT, and one from the district court. First, at appendix page 726, the court will find that Strategy specifically argued that the oligonucleotides that are synthesized during the reaction or mixing step cannot satisfy the second oligonucleotide requirement because...
But Mr. Lee, that sounds like an infringement issue rather than an upfront, forthright challenge to claim construction. And it's part of a section 5, which clearly deals with infringement. That doesn't sound like an upfront claim construction challenge.
Well, Your Honor, two responses to that question. The first is, it is because this was a summary judgment motion brought by TWT on infringement. That necessarily, under this court's decisions, implicates both claim construction and then the application of the correct claim construction to the facts.
Don't you need more than implicates? Don't you need a real challenge?
Your Honor, I would suggest that in this specific case where there had been an earlier claim construction in another case that had been settled a year before this case, this motion came to be heard, that it was enough. The standard is fair notice to the court and the other party. And if I could, Your Honor, focus on what was said, the statement at page 10-726 is, quote, the oligos cannot be, quote, provided, close quote, as defined by the patents in suit, unless they exist. Now, to go to Your Honor's question, the second part of my answer to your question is, I don't think that there was ambiguity either on the part of TWT or the district court. Because in response, what TWT said at appendix page 742 is this. In arguing that the second oligonucleotide cannot be provided as required by the asserted claim, Strategy essentially rehashes the argument presented and rejected by this court in the prior litigation. And then goes on to say, the court ruled on claim construction that, quote, the providing step and mixing step can occur simultaneously, and that, quote, claim reagents were not required to be provided fully formed before the limitation initiation of mixing step.
In other words, the best you can do in setting out a challenge to claim construction is to indicate what how your opponent characterized your views.
No, because, Your Honor, I think the first page, if I draw your attention to page 8, appendix 726, we have an explicit statement that the oligos cannot be provided as defined by the patents in suit unless they exist. I then, you are correct, respond with their characterization of that. But then the most important thing, Your Honor, is the court's statement in response to both arguments at page appendix 617. There is no language in the claim requiring any of the ingredients to be fully formed when they are added to the mix. So whatever each of us has said in the briefing, there is a clear statement of what providing means as defined by the claims.
Mr. Lee, let me ask you one
question. Surely. I'm sorry.
Let me ask you one question, if I could. You, in saying that you that the claim construction issue in Raisebook, you did not point to pages 709 through 713 and 730 through 733, in particular 732 through 733. Now you and Mr. Panels obviously know more about precisely what happened in the district court than I do, but I would have thought you would have mentioned in support of your argument those pages. Was there a reason you didn't? In other words, do those pages that I just mentioned not, in fact, address this claim construction issue?
Your Honor, what we cited to specifically were, Your Honor is correct, because one of the points we tried to make, perhaps not as effectively as we could, is there are sections of our brief called claim construction, sections of QWT's brief called claim construction, sections of the court's opinion called claim construction. That's in part what Your Honor has drawn our attention to. What we specifically try to cite in the pages that I'm trying to bring to the court's attention are one step down, which is having raised the issue of claim construction as part of the infringement inquiry. Did we make the specific argument that the providing, mixing steps are separate steps, and that the providing needs to be completed before you can mix said first oligo, said second oligo, said cleavage means. And so I think all of those go to that. Now, Mr. Powell's, in fairness, was there at the trial. I wasn't, so he may even know
but
more.
But are you saying that the pages I cited aren't pertinent to that? Because 709 through 713, you know, you've got about four pages there of laying out claim construction law. And then at 730, you can conclude at 713, I guess, with the claim construction argument. Then at 730 to 33, there's more. Is that particular claim construction issue not pertinent to what you were discussing with Judge Lurie?
No. Those pages, that entire section is pertinent to this issue because that was the core of what people were citing. In fact, Your Honor, the pages that fall in between the pages you cited are building upon what happened before page 724, making a specific argument and then moving on. And in fact, as Your Honor will see.
So the pages I noted, you would say, are pertinent.
They are relevant, without a doubt. And I think fairly, the briefing looked at as a whole, the parties did what this court has talked about. They argued the correct claim construction. There was the fact that there had been this earlier claim interpretation. But they then moved to how it would apply in this case.
But Mr. Lee, with respect to the waiver issue, aren't there really two elements? Not only the mixing aspect, but also the temperature. Is there a waiver of the temperature issue?
There is, Your Honor, but part of that confusion is this, is there was an argument about whether the providing step required that the oligos be preformed before the mixing step. Even after that was decided, there was a question about the temperature issue and thermocycling and whether that still created a non-infringement argument. The focus of our argument to you here today is the former rather than the latter. And what I think I can say three things in response to Your Honor's question. The structure of the claim, which sets forth a providing step, a mixing step that specifically describes mixing said oligos, referring back to the providing step, and referring to temperature conditions, is consistent with our claim interpretation. In fact, you do have to have temperature conditions that allows the annealing and the cleaving, and we've never suggested otherwise. Our only argument is that as these claims are structured and written, the providing step has to be completed first. Under the district court's claim interpretation, which is conceivably broader, that's the second point, you could have just had the claim read, mixing a first olive oil with a second olive oil, a clean instruction would have read exactly the same way. Second point I would make is that interpretation, which has preformed olive oils provided first, but under temperature conditions when mixed that allow annealing and cleavage, is consistent with all 26 of the examples of the invention that are described in the patent.
So would you limit it to those 26 examples, though?
I don't know. We wouldn't make that argument, Your Honor. I think that under Phillips, those 26 examples are instructive. And if you take, I would take three things, Your Honor. I would take the structure of the claims themselves, recognizing that under the broader interpretation adopted by the district court, you might render the providing steps superfluous. In fact, the sense in the second step becomes somewhat of a mystery. With that structure in mind, I think we would ask ourselves, is that interpretation that we've provided consistent with the specification? And the answer is, it is, because the examples that are there of the invention, there are many examples of different things in this very long patent, but there are 26 of this claimed invention. They are all consistent with that interpretation. And then other portions of the specification actually criticize methods like polymerase chain reaction, like TACMAN, where you would actually be synthesizing as part of the mixing process. And they're criticized for creating unwanted cleavage products, exponential amplification of those non-uniform cleavage products, and then probably most importantly, the specification says our invention to avoid all of that is to uncouple synthesis from this mixing reaction. That's consistent with our claim interpretation. And then you're on this, the file history, although not as unambiguous as the specification, talks a little bit about the temperature conditions that Your Honor described and said this invention allows for recycling. Well, polymerase chain reaction and TACMAN don't need recycling. They're generating their olive oils as part of the process.
But all of these processes are done at a certain temperature. Temperature is very critical element.
Critical is, for sure, is a critical element, but Your Honor, temperature would be a critical element. Whether you preform the oligos and then add them, because you still need the conditions for the cleaving process.
Or form during the mixing process.
Right. So the temperature condition is going to be critical under either of our claim interpretations. It is, and therefore, is not directly relevant or precisely relevant to the issue I'm urging upon the court, which is whatever the temperature conditions are for the cleavage reaction, this claim is structured in a manner so that if fairly read, actually expressly read, you provide first, you mix second, and then you get your cleavage structure third. And that's consistent with the specification. To directly answer Your Honor's question, I don't think that you limit it to the 26. I think they're just instructive. And the very small portion of the file history that addresses that is consistent with that.
But each one of those 26, though, there is a providing step and a mixing step.
Right.
Subsequent.
Right. And there's a preform providing step, there's a mixing step, and then, interestingly, and I think we pointed it out, there is a description of subsequent steps to the mixing step, even the separate. I'm into my rebuttal time, so let me just add one thought on the issue of damages. This case is different than many because the jury was explicitly informed that an injunction would issue. Indeed, it was TWT's witness who told the jury that an injunction would issue, and the damage period, therefore, was only 18 months. That's, in fact, what happened after the verdict. The injunction was issued and the product went off the market. This is a case in which the actual sales are $500,000. The projected sale on one document that every projected sale is on one document that everyone relies upon at appendix page 3004 had rejected sales of $1 million. Yet there's a jury verdict, which has now been trebled with attorney's fees on top of it, of close to $6 million, most of it in outcome fee. There is nothing that would justify that. It is grossly excessive. The idea that we want to get a foothold in the diagnostic market makes no sense. What TWT says to you in their brief is, well, you would have gotten a foothold, and then before the injunction issued, you would have redesigned your product to be non-infringing and stay in the market. Well, if that were true, we just would have redesigned our product, put the non-infringing product in the market, and gotten our foothold that way. Thank you.
Mr. Lee, we'll give you back your 3 minutes in rebuttal because we've asked a lot of questions. Mr. Pals, you're representing Third Wave, and no doubt you will be arguing waiver.
Sure, I will. Mark Pals on behalf of Third Wave with Eric Addison also. And I will start with waiver, Your Honor. And there is a flat, clear waiver in this case. The question presented by strategy for appeal on claim construction is whether the court erred in construing the term mixing to include a process in which the required allegations are made during the mixing step rather than being provided beforehand.
It's clear they had a different view of the claim construction than what the court did, isn't it?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think what they were doing was setting up what they thought was going to be a strong anticipation argument. And they thought they'd take this claim construction, maybe thinking they could undo their waiver later. But I think it's, from the evidence we cite on summary judgment, they clearly stated the providing step can be satisfied, provided, or if, to avoid using that word, if the components are provided before the end of the mixing step. They didn't require that and they were explicit in their terms, they did not require the components to be provided before the start of the mixing step. And that's really where the dispute comes down here. There is a flow to these claims, providing, mixing, detecting. But the issue is, you have to provide all four before you start mixing, or can you provide two, mix those, and provide the others during the mixing step? That's really the dispute. And they expressly waived an argument on claim construction that providing had to be completed before mixing started.
Which is what they're arguing. Yes, they did. I have no doubt that if you had been representing Stratagen or Mr. Lee had been representing Stratagen below, we would have seen very clear claim construction arguments, but that did not take place here. Certainly the claim construction arguments were not presented as you or probably Mr. Lee would have presented them. But it does seem that when you take all of the portions of the record that Judge Lurie discussed with Mr. Lee and that I discussed with Mr. Lee and some provisions of the district court's opinion or parts of it, for example, at 633 through 634 and I think 654 through 655 and 56, it's hard for me to escape the conclusion that inartfully, perhaps, a claim construction argument was advanced, number one, and number two, that Third Wave and the district court recognized it was being made. That's kind of where I am on it. Where am I wrong on that? I'm not asking that in an argumentative sense, but trying to sort of frame the question.
I understand. Now, we did say in our reply brief on summary judgment that they rehashed some claim construction arguments, and they did. They rehashed arguments on complementary and what was required to be fully complementary and what was required to form the cleavage structure. And that's part of what, Your Honor, that's part of the briefing that you asked Mr. Lee about. It's part of what the court's opinion is addressing here. It's not the providing before mixing point. It goes to to the relationship between the oligonucleotides that are annealed to the target. And there's talk about an enzyme that displaces the downstream oligo and moves it out of the way. And in the 314 patent in particular, that oligo has to be able to come back and anneal or hybridize or bind to the target.
So you're saying, excuse me for interrupting, but you're saying that what's 712 through 713, 709 through 712 being just general claim construction language, and what's 730 through 33, yes, it's a claim construction argument, but not the one that's now pertinent. So you disagree with Mr. Lee, because he said it was pertinent.
Yeah,
said
it is. I do not believe it is pertinent, and it's not clear to me it's a claim construction argument more than a non-infringement argument. Here's what they're saying.
At these pages?
Yes. What they're talking about is this enzyme, and this enzyme moves along, and it builds on the upstream olive, so it makes it long. And as it does that, it moves away the downstream olive. It displaces it.
In their system.
That's what's being discussed. That's what happens in their system. Okay. They're saying, well, if that infringes, then the patents are anticipated by TACNAM. Because in the TACNAM reaction that you're talking about more than you thought you would about, what happens is there's a big enzyme and it moves down.
It's just one as opposed to two in the strategy system.
Exactly. There's one enzyme as opposed to two. And what happens is, as the TACNAM enzyme moves down, it makes that upstream olive longer, but when it reaches the other one, and this is what's in the Holland paper and the other ones, it chews that down. But they're saying, if we're covered, then it must cover TACNAM, because the structure should be the same. The answer to that is, that's wrong. That's an infringement issue, and it's wrong. Because what happens, and what the district court found is, their enzyme falls off. And when that enzyme falls off, what can happen, and the only remaining question for trial, was whether the downstream oligo comes back down. That was the only reason we didn't get summary judgment of infringement. And at trial, we proved that happened. So this isn't going to the providing before mixing argument, as I understand what you're saying. And the providing before mixing argument is the argument waived in the context of the summary judgment briefing, where they explicitly said, as long as it's done prior to completion of mixing, that claim limitation is satisfied.
Is that the only item on waiver that you would agree with? What about temperature? Think the temperature argument is waived?
They appear to agree now that you can have temperature variations during the mixing step, and that's acceptable. There's some question in my mind as to whether they're saying the mixing step ends at some point in time, but on their reply brief, they've come back and said, no, you can have reaction conditions, including temperature changes. They do say, but you can't have temperature changes that would allow making an oligo during the mixing step. That goes back to providing before mixing. So I see that. It's the only issue they asked for review on. And I see that as the issue. Is there providing? Must the providing step be completed as to all four components before the start of the mixing? That's the issue.
What would happen if the providing step was not there?
If the providing step...
You eliminate the providing step in the process.
If the providing step weren't there, you wouldn't have definitions of target nucleic acid, first oligo, second oligo.
So you would have to provide the oligo before mixing?
No. You have to provide... I may have misunderstood your question. But each component needs to be provided before it can be mixed. I agree with that. But not every component has to be sitting there on a lab bench or something before you mix any two of them together. And I disagree with the comments Mr. Lee made about the examples. The examples do not specify that all four are sitting there, done, ready to be combined, sitting on a lab bench. They say, mix two of these together, and then add these. They don't say that the synthesis is completed on those others. They don't require that the synthesis be completed on those others.
So does the oligotype have to be fully formed prior to the mixing step? Isn't that the real crux of the issue?
The real crux of the issue is, does every component have to be fully formed before you start any aspect of the mixing step? That's as precisely as I can say what I think they're arguing. That's the issue they weigh, but I'd argue as well, just from the language of the claim, there is a flow to the claim, providing mixing detecting, as I said before. They seem to really put a lot of emphasis on the word set that appears in the mixing step, refers to said first oligonucleotide, said second oligonucleotide. Well, if you look at the providing paragraph, there are Romanets in there, 1, 2, and 3 in one of the patents, 1, 2, 3, 4 in the other. And in each of those, one will define the target nucleic acid. The next one comes back and says, first oligonucleotide has certain properties relative to said target nucleic acid. They don't even argue that you have to provide in the order specified in those Romanet numeral steps. That wouldn't be logical. They don't argue that. The examples don't do that. So there's the word set isn't going to carry the day. The Altieris case came down and said the word set doesn't carry the day. And it doesn't carry the day here.
But it does refer back to the mixture of what's in the mixture, doesn't it?
It refers to the target in defining the properties, yes. But it doesn't say you must have that present before you mix two of the other things together.
How can you mix the cleavage means, the target, the first oligonucleotide, and the second, if you don't have them?
Well, unless I'm going to all add them simultaneously, all at once. They don't argue as required either. And one of the patents says
one patent says in any order, so you would add 4, 3, 2, 1.
That's correct.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Yes. So
have,
you before you mix one, you have to have it. I will agree with that completely. But that doesn't mean before you mix two of them, you have to have number 3 and 4. That's what their construction would require. It would require 1, 2, 3, 4 all lined up, ready to go.
Aren't they saying that you can't have them generated in situ in a reaction mixture?
There's a nuance to their argument that goes that way, but what they're arguing is that they have to exist fully formed beforehand, before the mixing step starts, regardless of how you're going to make them, whether you make them chemically or enzymatically. They have to exist fully formed beforehand. That's their argument. And I would argue that's completely illogical, because if somebody practicing this method started,
it's not a matter of logic, it's a matter of reading the claim.
Well, it's both. Under Altieris and under case law, it's a matter of the language. And the language, on its terms, doesn't dictate an order. There's no then, there's no thereafter. You don't see the kind of language you see in Mantac or other cases.
But you couldn't provide before you mixed.
You can provide certain components.
Could you mix before you provide?
You can. If I'm going to mix first oligo, second oligo, target, and cleavage means, I could mix the cleavage means and the target nucleic acid while I'm just finishing the synthesis of the first oligo and second oligo, and then add those in. There's no reason, by logic or language, and actually the evidence is uncontradicted in the record, that one of ordinary skill in the art would read it the way I'm saying.
Mr. Tiles, what about damages?
Damages, Your Honor?
Reasonable royalty. How can that include an upfront royalty?
Case law from this court supports an upfront royalty as an appropriate measure of damages where the evidence supports it, Your Honor. In this case, there is agreement where the biotech industry...
Which case?
We've cited it, Your Honor. I can't remember the name of it. I apologize.
My
collection is it has one of those very long names, and I apologize. Here, the evidence is in the biotech industry that upfront payments are common. And it's not just our expert, it's their expert as well that indicated that there were upfront payments in this industry.
Yeah, but does that constitute reasonable royalty? Sure, they may be common as part of a deal, but looking backwards, are they reasonable royalty? Quite a short period of time.
Let me address first the concept of an upfront payment. I would say yes, that's reasonable and appropriate under the circumstances in this industry for this type of technology that people would agree to a license with an upfront payment.
Is it your strongest argument that that's what the jury found?
Well, the jury heard all this evidence. They heard the evidence, and there's substantial evidence on the common aspect in the industry. They heard evidence as to the magnitude. And the jury didn't pick a high-end number, they didn't pick a low-end number, they picked a number in the middle that was actually less than Third Wave's expert testified was the number that would have been agreed to by the parties. So the jury picked a number within the range of numbers and data and information presented. That information included evidence about the Kaplan reaction, although they've complained and said it's not comparable. They actually tout that I think it's A5025 in the appendix, the comparability of their technology, which is infringing and therefore patented technology,
didn't,
to the tech.
Didn't Stravagene think they weren't infringing? Or were they proceeding as if they weren't infringing?
The jury found they didn't have a reasonable basis for believing they didn't infringe. So I don't know what was actually in their mind, Your Honor, but the jury found otherwise. So the data and the evidence on the images is, supports fair compensation to Third Wave in the amount that was awarded. The jury heard all the arguments about whether a reasonable corporation or whether Stravagene would agree to this, and it's only 18 months, and so on and so forth, and rejected. As far as the evidence,
the license only for 18 months, and the jury takes it from the level of the patent. Is that reasonable or unreasonable?
The jury, the information that was presented to the jury was that this would be an 18-month license, Your Honor. And there's no reason to expect the jury to do anything other than what they were asked to do with respect to the evidence presented and the questions asked.
Let me interrupt you at the end of your time, but I'm going to give you up to 3 minutes more because we're giving Mr. Lee 3 minutes.
Counsel, let me ask you one question. Turning to the issue of claim construction, what happens in this case if this panel, speaking hypothetically, were to disagree with the district court's claim construction and the one you urge and adopt Mr. Lee's? What does that mean happens in the case? Does it mean it goes back? Does it mean judgment gets entered in favor of Stravagene? Or what? What will be your view on that? I know that's an eventuality that you do not favor, but I just, given the issues and the parameters of the case, it's one we have to, you know, hear what your views are.
Globally, it encourages parties to take do-overs on claim construction and concede them to raise their arguments later. Here, what it does is it has, I think, a different effect on different components of the case. I think they still infringe. If you can't start the mixing step until all four ingredients have been provided, then I still think they infringe. But that's an issue that I think, realistically, is probably one for the district court to consider in the first instance. From an invalidity standpoint, I don't think any of their invalidity arguments depend on the claim construction. And I think those could stand. I think they should stand. From a damages standpoint, I don't think the damages determination depends on the claim construction. If they're ultimately found to infringe, I see no reason why damages should be affected. And then the last component they raise are enhanced fees enhanced damages and attorney's fees. I think realistically, those would probably be reconsidered by the district court.
So we could affirm on claim construction and send it back for restructuring the damages.
If the issue were with respect to damages, then I believe the answer is correct, Your Honor. It would be sent back, my understanding is sent back to the district court to address damages either on the mitigator or a new trial or an option of either. Thank you.
Charles, 3 minutes. Let me start off, Mr. Lee, by quoting something from the district court's opinion. We're always looking for good literature and judicial opinions. The sheer effrontery of this assertion is breathtaking. I know you were not trial counsel, but...
I think I know what you're going to read, though.
And your answer to that is... what we were talking about before, which is the best you've got.
Your Honor, I don't think, I think it, I offered it because it was specific, but in part in answer to Judge Shaw's question, Ms. Pirazzolo reminded me that in fact, at our reply brief at page 3, we also identified in response to WT's brief, portions at pages 713, 726, 729, where we made the argument, and what Your Honor will see is, it is expressly this argument. Can you mix them? Can you provide them if they are made in situ? And it's explicit a half a dozen times. Now, without a doubt, trial counsel and the district court got off the rails with each other.
That's a non-infringement argument.
No, Your Honor, because what we say is, we'll say that it says cannot be provided as defined by these claims. So it is, yes, a non-infringement argument, but one that's dependent upon claim interpretation. So we, in fact, refer to the reply to some of the pages Judge Schall identified.
What's your response, Mr. Lee, to Mr. Powell's contention that the material at page 712 through 713, and I guess 730 through 733, does not, in fact, speak to what I'll refer to by way of shorthand as the providing slash mixing issue?
Well,
you heard what he said.
I did. In fact, Your Honor, you'll find at page 713 that we specifically addressed that issue, and the same is true at 726, the same is true at 729. So this question of whether they could
Where do you address it at 713?
Let me just get our reply.
712 to 713, precisely. It's important, because he says, no, no, you don't at that point, or the strategy you did at that point.
Let me give you the precise quotes, Your Honor. And I can just get our reply. At page 713, we say first, strategy does not provide either of the two required oligonucleotides.
That's headed by the heading in the paragraph, strategy's products cannot infringe.
Right. What else?
Doesn't sound like a claim construction challenge.
Well, Your Honor, but infringement has to implicate both claim interpretation and the fact. And then,
what about what's at the bottom of 712, going over to 713?
Oh, I'm sorry, I was looking at 713.
You mean, as discussed here on the claims, must
yes.
be construed to require fully complementary oligonucleotides? Is that the...
That paragraph, going over to 713.
That is, that actually is, leads into the argument, but I think Mr. Pallas is correct. This goes to more of the overlap argument that results from anticipation.
Okay, now what about at 730? What I'm really thinking about is 732 through 733. Specifically, the paragraph begins, therefore, if the court were to construe.
I think that does relate, Your Honor, because it builds on what's on page 729. And at page 729, our quote is, quote, a primer extended by a polymerase never infringe the patents in suit because it cannot be produced prior to the end of the mixing step.
That's 729?
Yes.
Which paragraph is that? Sorry to...
No, that's... No, this is...
Get down in the mud here on these
I think
statements, but they're important here, I think.
I think they're...
Muddy issues.
Oh, I see, up at the top.
Up at the top, Robert. And then it moves into the question of indirect infringement.
Okay, so you're saying 729 sets up what you say at 732 to 33.
That's correct. And, Your Honor, I think, let me just make three final points. This difference in the claim interpretation really is emphasized by the anticipation arguments. If our claim interpretation is correct, and you cannot form them in situ, then the difference between the pioneering TACNET work and this work is that the oligos are preformed.
Second point.
Second point is, the issue is not as Mr. Powell has described, which is, what's formed at the time you're mixing what else? It's a question of whether you can form the oligos in situ, and we would call to the court's attention column 27, lines 37 to 40. Of the 543 patent that specifically talks about decoupling synthesis from the mixing reaction.
Column 27?
Column 27, lines 37 to line 44, which says the ability to uncouple the synthetic activity of the enzyme from the 5' nuclease activity proves that the 5' nuclease activity does not require concurrent DNA synthesis, describing the invention. Last point, there are upfront payments in the area of biotechnology, but there are upfront payments when you're getting a license for the term of the patent. This is not an area that the court has addressed in any detail, but the problem with upfront payments, particularly when you're comparing them to licenses that extend the lifetime of the patent, is it's double dipping. Presuming an upfront payment that would extend throughout the lifetime of the patent, when you're in a circumstance where the injunction will issue before the lifetime has been exhausted, results in a double recovery, and that's what's occurred here.
I understand your points. The case is well argued. Thank you, gentlemen. The case is taken under submission.